So the topic for tonight and the weekend is really the same, which is good for me. And of course, it gives me the opportunity, gives us the opportunity, those of you who will be there through the weekend, or at least part of the weekend, to go into much greater depth. There will be some people coming tomorrow who are not here tonight, and so I'll probably just repeat the beginning of what I'm about to say. But the exploration of these qualities that together are known as the four Brahmaviharas, it's a pretty big exploration. These are pretty subtle states, and they're also states we tend to have a lot of ideas about. And so the actual practices to explore them and discussion to explore them, I think, is a very rich experience. So the phrase is from Pali, which is the language of the original Buddhist texts. The phrase is Brahmavihara. Brahma means celestial, supreme, heavenly. One translation I heard for the word Brahma, which I liked a lot, was best. Vihara means dwelling or abiding or home. So these four qualities, which collectively are known as the four Brahmaviharas, are said to be our best home. And like any home, of course, we're not there all the time, but there is a certain feeling when we get back home. There's a certain sense when we get back home. It should be the place where we feel the most authentic, the most relaxed, the most ourselves, the least pretentious. It's like, hey, we're home. Right? So together, these four qualities are called our best home. Sometimes the collection, the bundle, they're known as the four boundless states. There are lots of ways that they're referred to. The first of these states is loving kindness. The word in Pali is metta, M-E-T-T-A. And I just had the really fun experience of seeing the photograph when we first moved into the building. That's the Insight Meditation Society. It was a novitiate. It was a Catholic novitiate. It was run by the Fathers of the Blessed Sacrament. And that's what it said in big letters up above the doorway, Fathers of the Blessed Sacrament. And we got somebody to get up on a very tall ladder on a very cold day. And we said, could you please rearrange those letters so it says something about us, about who we are. So they got up on the ladder, and they played around with the letters, and they came up with metta, M-E-T-T-A. So what ensued was really a lot of debate, because what we were doing in establishing that center had actually never been done before in this country. It was the first center sort of established by Westerners that wasn't referring back to a kind of single Asian teacher or monastery. And we had all kinds of stuff we were trying to figure out, like everything. So there's a big debate about this word. You know, why don't you put up an English word? Nobody knows what that word means. Why have a word up there? Nobody knows what it means. And you're not in Asia anymore, you know. And the point of view that wanted it to stay up there prevailed, which made me very happy because that was my point of view. My point of view does not always prevail there. But I like it. I like that when somebody, say, calls for directions, whoever picks up the phone can say it's a large brick building with white pillars. It's got this word up on top, metta, M-E-T-T-A. And then they usually say, what does that mean? And we get to say that means love, or that means loving kindness. So through the years, you know, when you're in an intensive retreat and you're silent for a week and you've got really nothing else to do but kind of scrutinize everything around you. So all these people have said to me, this is through 40 years, it couldn't have been that it said Fathers of the Blessed Sacrament, because the M is like weird, and you know, they couldn't possibly have taken those letters and turned it into metta. So of course, as my own memory has started to fade, I think, did it happen that way? I was sure it happened that way. Maybe I made it up. But somebody actually found the photo it said Fathers of the Blessed Sacrament, and you could see how they made the M, you know, and what they did to do that. So I felt like completely vindicated that yes, that is what happened. And it is, in a way, what we wanted to present to the world. This quality of loving kindness, the sense of love, it's very difficult to translate, actually. Like, if you think about the many, many ways any one of us might use the word love. And I've had scholars say to me that a better translation of metta rather than loving kindness is love. Not everybody, but some people do assert that. But look at all the different ways we use that word. I mean, sometimes we really, frankly, mean a medium of exchange. You know, I will love you as long as you love me in return. Or I will love myself as long as I never make a mistake. Or, like, we know that state, and we know how bound up it is in circumstance and how conditional it is and how fragile, how breakable it is. I mean, really, I will love myself as long as I never make a mistake. You know, it doesn't last long. So that's not really what metta is meant to imply. And the term loving kindness, well, the most common term, I mean, I certainly use it, and many people use it, is a fine translation, but it's hard to even know what it means, right? Just in the sense of a conventional, ordinary conversation. If somebody introduced the word loving kindness, it would sound a little archaic or a little weird in some way. The literal translation of metta is friendship. And it means developing the art of friendship. First of all, toward oneself, and then toward all of life, toward all beings everywhere. That's a fine, obviously, it's a fine translation, is the translation. But I wonder about that word too, because one of the things about loving kindness, as we experience it, as we cultivate it, as we deepen it, is that it actually doesn't mandate a certain kind of action. Right? It's an inner space that guides our worldview, that shifts the motivational base out of which we're acting. So, for example, if they say if we have largely been motivated by fear in what we do and what we say and what we refrain from doing or saying, and we deepen loving kindness, we'll find we're coming more and more from a place of connection. Is that what's motivating us? That's what's inspiring us to do something or say something or hold back from doing or saying something. So it's the inner place of motivation that's really transformed. It's not a mandate like, we will know you're coming from a loving place when you do give all that money to the person on the street, or you let that person move in, or you say yes, or you're only sweet, or, you know, it's not determining, it's not demanding a kind of action. It's about the inner space. And that is a very freeing notion for a lot of people, because there are an awful lot of people, and I think quite reasonably, who feel very squeamish about this notion, like, really? Have loving kindness for, you know, strangers and people I actually don't like, and because it implies to us, like, oh God, now I have to say yes. Now I have to be acquiescent. Now I have to give in. Now I have to let go or give up all my sense of principle or intensity or conviction. But it's not about that, right? It's about that inner place we're coming from. And that is something we'll go through a lot more over the weekend. So rather than coming from a place of alienation and fear and disdain, we cultivate the motivational understanding that our lives are connected. We have something to do with one another. We can respond with intensity. We can respond with boundaries. We can respond by saying no. But that doesn't have to come from hatred either. Right? So that's why I say it's a very profound and subtle exploration. What is a worldview where we're not thinking so much in terms of self and other and us and them, and it is more a sense of we, actually. In fact, it's a worldview that's more truthful, it's more accurate, because life is interconnection. It's not this kind of solitary endeavor. Even just as a simple example, sometimes if I'm invited into a company or a workplace to teach, one of the questions I ask people to reflect on is, how many other people need to be doing their job well so you can do your job well? Right? Because we're quite an interdependent network, whatever we do. Even if it's just, if you work all alone, you know, your mode of transportation, who grew your food, you know? I mean, there are ways in which our lives are about connection. And to acknowledge that, to open to that, can only make us stronger, because it happens to be true. And the more in defiance of that we live, the more we're kind of alienated from the truth, and therefore it's almost like the proverbial banging your head against the wall. It's just not the way things work. And so we suffer, we cause suffering, all kinds of things ensue from that. The more we understand this is the reality of things, not that you like everybody and not that you're going to take them home, but you have that sense of acknowledgement. It's funny because I'm working on another book. I'm almost done. You are the last group, I believe, through the weekend of people who can teach me about love, because it's about love. And then I'm done. Like, I'm extremely late with this book. It's really shameful. But I am, and I just got a firm deadline of August 1st, but I'm going on retreat July 28th. I'm flying to England to go on retreat, to sit a retreat, so it's going in. So it's about love. It's called Real Love, and it won't come out till May, but that's, you know, publishing is kind of slow industry. So it's going in. And one of the things, as I've done groups with people, that came up that was sort of interesting was that somebody said in this early group I did in Barrie at the retreat center, they said, all my life I thought that liking somebody was sort of the lesser standard, and loving them was like this rare and supreme and unusual connection. And you're almost saying loving everybody is the standard or possibility. It's the widespread possibility, and liking somebody is much more rare and, you know, unusual in particular. And I thought, you know what? That's right. I am saying that. Not love in a particular emotional, you know, effusive state, but that profound sense of connection. We are teaching. That is a possibility with all of life. Liking somebody is a whole other story, you know. You may not want to ever spend time with this person or take them home or, you know, whatever. And that's fine. You know, you don't have to. That's not the proof that you're a loving person. But what's happening in your heart in terms of wishing well or some state like that of inclusion rather than exclusion? That's the point. So that's loving kindness. The second quality is compassion. And this, too, is very difficult to understand. I think we have all kinds of notions of what compassion is, and a lot of it, sometimes for some people, it involves a kind of devastation or debilitation or as proof that we really care. But in the Buddhist tradition, compassion is defined as, in many ways, one way is as the trembling or the quivering of the heart in response to seeing pain or suffering. So it's a movement of the heart, and it's a movement toward to see if we can be of help. Right? So it's not the same as feeling bad. It's not the same as feeling overwhelmed, because then how could you move toward, right? It's too hard. It's not the same as moving into someone's suffering to burn up because of it. It's a movement toward to see if we can be of help. And it's very much almost a sense of equality. Like, sometimes people think of compassion almost like this very hierarchical state, like I, whose life is so together and always will be, and bestowing this kindness on you, like way down there, because your life has fallen apart, which mine never, ever, ever could, because guess what? It could. I mean, the truth is, it's not at all that we bear the same measure of pain, because clearly we don't, all of us, each of us. But the kind of vulnerability to change, the insecurity of life, the uncertainty of life, absolutely we are all vulnerable in those ways. And that's kind of the place that compassion comes from, not like superior to inferior, right? It's, ooh, look at what life can bring. Look at that. It's a very profound study, the study of compassion, because we're all over the place with it. So many times we do move into and burn up, or burn out, really. So many times we are overwhelmed. So many times we think we're kind of being compassionate, but when we really look, there's a whole lot else going on. Wanting to be the savior, wanting to avoid our own discomfort, all kinds of things going on. So I find it really fascinating and a very deep process to really look at that state. The third Brahmavihara is sympathetic joy, and that's almost like the energetic opposite of compassion. If compassion teaches us, for many of us, a very different way of looking at pain and opening to pain, our own or someone else's, sympathetic joy reminds us to look at the joy, to look at the delight, to look at what's good in life, because we need them both in order to have a kind of balance. Sympathetic joy literally means joy in the happiness of others. Sometimes people these days don't like the word sympathetic in that context, because for them, sympathy is so tied in with compassion. But it's sympathetic in the sense of like vibing together, you know, the resonance. So, and that's like the older translation, so I just use it since my acquaintance with all of this stuff was older. So sympathetic joy is happiness and the happiness of others. Rather than witnessing someone's success or good fortune and falling sway to the voice that so often arises in our heads that says, ew, I wish you had a little bit less going for you right now. Like, you don't have to lose everything, but if the light could just dim a bit, I'd feel better about myself. So, in contrast to that very common state, sympathetic joy is actually being happy for someone else's happiness. And I feel I know, probably perhaps we all know people who just have that naturally. It's just part of their being. Like, something good happens for you and they're so happy for you. And other people, it's not there, you know. For most of us, it's not all that natural. It's like a training. It really is a training. And it's part of this complex of practices around loving kindness. So it's a training because there are a lot of assumptions we tend to make very quickly about life over and over again that really make it more difficult to feel that kind of free flow of sympathetic joy. Assumptions like, you have everything and you will forever. And I have nothing, and I will forever. So of course there are a few big problems with that. One is, nothing is forever, nothing. Another is, it is so unlikely that I have nothing, nothing at all. It may feel that way because we're not taking any time to just notice and appreciate what we have. And it's also pretty unlikely that you have everything, right? So we need to first almost kind of like unearth that assumption, see it, be able to relinquish it, and look anew at our experience. And there are a lot of assumptions like that that tend to get in the way of sympathetic joy, but that's part of the process, right? Is to see those obstacles. So there's loving kindness, there's compassion, there's sympathetic joy, and then the last of the four Brahmaviharas is this quality called equanimity. In some systems, actually, they begin with talking about equanimity, because in a lot of ways it's the secret ingredient in the other three. Equanimity means balance. And in this context, it's the balance born of wisdom. It's like having perspective on things. You know, when you really don't understand something and you're all freaked out, and then you learn, you have a different sense of understanding. You can say, oh yeah, that's just going to take some time. Or, oh, there are lots of angles to look at this with. Or, you know, I don't have to be so caught up in some way. It's balance. It does not mean indifference. It doesn't mean coldness. It doesn't mean not caring or pulling back. It's perspective. It's balance. And as the voice of wisdom, which it is, it's the essential ingredient in these other states. Otherwise, they can't sort of reach their fullest potential. They can't really flower. They can't become more boundless, like beyond maybe a certain group that we consider our team, right? So my first meditation teacher, I began practice in January of 1971, a long time ago. This January, same night, January 7th, that my first retreat began, and I happened to be teaching in New York City. And it just came to me, like, wow, this is my 45th anniversary of learning how to meditate. So I said it, and I saw the owner of the studio I was in, who was a friend of mine, like, go running out the door. And I called out, are you getting me a cake? Which he was. So my first meditation teacher was S.N. Goenka. And he used to go around all the time saying, be equanimous, be equanimous, be equanimous. And we used to whisper to one another, is that a word? Did you ever hear that word before? What does that mean? I never heard that word. So equanimous is an even weirder form, but even the word equanimity, I think, for many of us, immediately implies kind of, I don't care. You know, and a sort of coldness. And it's really not meant to. It's balance. So when I say it's the secret ingredient in the others, when we do a loving kindness meditation, as an example, which we'll do a lot of over the weekend, rather than resting our attention on the feeling of the breath, we rest our attention on the repetition of certain phrases. And those phrases are the way that we're shifting the way we pay attention, right? So maybe we're including those we usually exclude. Or looking at ourselves rather than only thinking about the things we don't like. We're shifting our attention to wishing ourselves well, right? So it's the vehicle, those phrases, for attention being different. So we use very common words. We use very sort of general phrases so that we can make that offering to ourselves and to others without having to deliberate, like, what about you, you know? In which case, we lose all the force of the concentration. So common phrases are things like, you know, may you be happy, may you be peaceful. And without any equanimity, it sort of becomes something like, may you be happy by, let's say, Tuesday. You know, I might be able to give you till Wednesday, but I've got a really long list of people to make happy, and, you know. And speaking of lists, here's your list of everything you need to change in order to be truly happy, right? So what was once more like a freely given gift starts having a lot of strings attached, inevitably, right? And it's the equanimity saying, the wisdom that says, I can't control your choices, actually. I can wish you well, I can offer, I can be there. I can't make you happy. And with compassion, the same thing, certainly. How many times do we get into trouble because we forget? Oh, I'm not in control of the universe, after all. Right? We care, we try, we're present, and wisdom tells us we're not actually in control. You can't make someone change. You can't make healing happen faster, or at all. You can't insist that the universe go in one direction and not in another. We're there. It doesn't mean we're pulling back. In fact, that's what gives us the strength to hang in there. It's a very supple kind of strength, because the more expectation and demand and insistence we have, the harder it is to go through the inevitable ups and downs of any situation and the frustration and the impatience. So equanimity is like what bolsters compassion and allows us to have that kind of openness and open-heartedness in the face of all kinds of change. So it's right in there. That's why those systems that choose to do that teach it actually first. It doesn't have to be first in that literal sense, but it's got to be there in some way. So we have loving kindness, we have compassion, we have sympathetic joy, we have equanimity. They each actually have their own particular meditation, if you choose to pursue it in that way, if like one speaks to you or maybe especially challenges you in some way. They're all done through the silent repetition of certain phrases. Most commonly, we practice in a way that we're going to practice through the weekend, which is that we take one vehicle, like the vehicle of loving kindness, and we bring in all four states through that one vehicle. It's like if you're offering loving kindness to a friend who's really struggling, as an example, that becomes like a compassion meditation. If you're offering loving kindness to a friend who's really doing well, that becomes like a sympathetic joy meditation. Something like that. And equanimity is always there, right? Because it's the expansive quality that allows these other qualities to be truly like freely given. So there are lots of ways of going about it. And of course, we develop these qualities. You don't need a formal meditation practice in order to develop it. It doesn't have to be that kind of meditation practice. I think even doing what we did, I'm fascinated by that moment. You know, you felt one breath, two breaths, three breaths, then you're gone. That moment when you realize, oh, it's been quite some time since I last felt a breath. Because how are we there? There's tremendous opportunity right there to develop more kindness for ourselves and the ability to let go and to have self-compassion in that sense, which becomes the basis for compassion for others. And so whatever we pursue with that kind of consciousness, I think really is a very rich ground out of which to strengthen these states. So why don't we do some discussion?
Yeah, as you talk about the four Brahma Viharas, it's kind of interesting to me that they don't seem to stand by themselves. Like they're almost like they interrelate, but not even on a equal way. It's just kind of like an interrelationship type of. Do you agree with that, or what's your...
So the comment was about talking about these four states, the four Brahma Viharas. None of them seem to stand on their own. They seem to kind of interrelate. I think that's true. I think that is true. I think that it doesn't have to be as explicit as I just made it, because I think that you're only doing loving kindness practice, I think the pitfalls that appear kind of show us the need for the others, the other qualities, especially, you know, first and foremost, equanimity. Because we get so filled with desire, you know, may you be really, really happy. And it's natural to go there. It said that the near enemy of loving kindness, near enemy is a state that on the surface can look awfully close to the Brahma-Vihara state. It's only when we look much more carefully that we see how very different they are. So the near enemy of loving kindness is attachment. So that's also confusing for us, because these days, of course, with attachment theory and psychology, it's like we want attachment, right? The last thing we want is an insecure, disordered attachment issue. But it's a different sense of it's a different way of using the word attachment. Within the Buddhist psychology, it doesn't mean like bonding or nurturing or that ability to connect. It actually means sort of like control. You know, it's an effort to be in control, which doesn't help. I once met, I heard a presentation by a psychologist whose name I cannot remember, but he's in my book somewhere, my next book, who said that he was in the somewhat peculiar position once, and I guess he specializes in attachment theory in psychology, in Western psychology. He was in a somewhat peculiar position of having to teach the Dalai Lama about attachment. And he wasn't a practitioner, he wasn't a Buddhist, but he did a lot of reading to try to figure out what to say. And he said his conclusion after all that reading was that what Buddhists mean by non-attachment is what Western psychologists mean by secure attachment. I thought that was interesting. You know, there's a certain lack of rigidity. Some people here look like they can explain it better than I. There's a certain lack of rigidity, you know, and kind of reification of self and other in these very rigid terms. You know, so yes, I mean, equanimity's got to be there. And then it just happens, you know, that a lot of sorrow can come up doing loving kindness practice. You know, as soon as you say, may all beings be happy, it's like, whoa, we're kind of far from that, aren't we? You know, and there's a tremendous amount of grief that can come up, and a lot of things that really elicit, in the best case scenario, elicit a different sense of a need for compassion and a differentiation of compassion from other states, which are more like being engulfed. And inevitably, you know, it's not that, it's interesting, like of those four, loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity, a lot of teachers would say sympathetic joy tends to be the most difficult. Not for everybody, but for many. You know, often we don't feel compassion in a certain situation because we're simply not tuned into the suffering in that situation. And once we kind of feel, oh, that must be a really painful place, then compassion can more easily arise. But to actually feel happy for somebody who, you know, just hit a year on the New York Times bestseller list, like, and you're an author, it's like, it's not easy, you know? So you run into that all the time in your practice, like, may you be happy, kind of, you know, like, or, you know, not that happy, but, you know, like. And so we need that cultivation for loving kindness to be more widespread, you know, not for a more narrow range. So we're always sort of inevitably working with all of them in some way. Yeah. How do you practice emptiness, or how do you realize emptiness? Okay, so what's my understanding of emptiness in terms of the Brahma Viharas? I think there are different ways of looking at that. Within Buddhist teaching, certainly within Tibetan Buddhist teaching, there are two aspects of reality that are often spoken about. One is the relative and one is the absolute. And seeing the more absolute truth of something should never negate the relative truth of it. If it does, it means we're stuck. Right? We're stuck in some kind of nihilistic space. So, an example would be if you looked at a chair through an electron microscope, you would see it's mostly space. But if that meant you could never sit down, you're in trouble. Right? So, seeing more deeply into, let's say, emptiness, which I'll talk about in a minute, doesn't negate relatedness. It doesn't negate cause and effect. It doesn't negate the fact that hatred feels one way and love feels another. It doesn't negate that actions born of hatred have certain kinds of consequences. Actions born out of love have other kinds of consequences. So you could say, certainly that loving kindness and all the Brahma Viharas are relative practices. That's true. They're not designed to kind of give us a more penetrating understanding of emptiness, although sometimes that happens because you really do see interconnection, which is the other face of emptiness. And the practices that are absolute, like mindfulness practices, insight practices, which are absolute, I keep saying that, certainly designed to give us a greater sense of the absolute truth of something like emptiness, can exist in truth without the other side of things. Because then you don't have a life. You know, and it just becomes a sort of weird cerebral thing that is very nihilistic. So emptiness in this sense doesn't mean blankness, and it doesn't mean nothing's happening, and even the idea of no self doesn't mean that, you know, if you hit it, like, in that sitting, you're going to dissolve into a puddle, you know, or, like, we're going to end up as a soup, you know, like... It's not that. The idea is really that the way we tend to hold things denies different levels, including a level of insubstantiality, where what they say is that nothing exists from its own side. That is, nothing exists apart from causes and conditions, right? So... An example would be Thich Nhat Hanh, the Zen, Vietnamese Zen teacher, holding up a string bean, which you've seen him do. And he'll say, now, you know, see the sunshine in the string bean. Because string bean is not like a thing that is solid and concrete. The string bean is a combination of a lot of things coming together, right? The soil and the quality of the soil in which it was, the seed was planted, and who planted the seed, and you know, what affects the quality of the soil. It's like the rainfall and the air and the sun, and you know, so by the time he's finished the analysis of breaking down the string bean, he'll basically now see the world, right? So where is the string bean? It's a combination of all these things coming together and coming apart. It's very sort of dreamlike in a way, instead of this concrete, substantial, reified world that we tend to live in with ourselves and with others. But again, it's just like looking at the electron at the chair through the electron microscope. You got to sit down sometimes, right? So that level remains. How are you in that neighborhood over there?
You spoke at the beginning about seeing the conversations about what's happening in the world right now, sort of the glad to see that love and compassion are still in conversation. And all the people say, I don't even know what to do. What's the solution? And often what I see people saying is, I don't know what to do. I guess I'll just try to be good. I guess I'll just, like, love's all I can do. It seems like that's what a lot of people think of religion. And I wonder if you could just speak about how Ramadhyas and Meta can be a response, and how you can use it in an active way.
Mm-hmm. Okay, so the question was, going back to what I said much earlier when we were first gathering here about the this time in the world and how I was glad to see that love and qualities like love and compassion were at least still a part of the conversation, and people sometimes turning to that. But what does that look like in the realm of action, you know? I think it manifests. I mean, I never associated it with religion, so that was an interesting comment, you know? I think it manifests in many ways. One is some sense of both from looking at our own experience, you know, just through mindfulness of seeing times when we feel ourselves incredibly alienated and divided and when someone doesn't count for anything. And what that's like internally and what that's like externally in terms of the actions we can take towards someone when they don't count, they don't matter. Right, when we've objectified somebody and they have become an object rather than a person or creature or whatever. And you really see, you can do anything in that state because it doesn't seem to matter. And that includes we can do anything in that state. So I think it really starts there and understanding that depth of disconnection. And some combination of hope and belief that reweaving connection, starting with ourselves, is an effective tool to begin to help reweave connection in the world around us. I think when you really feel overwhelmed by the suffering, I think, you know, the companions are despair and a sense of great futility, and that's really the, you know, we use something like loving kindness as an antidote to that. Because I do have a very strong belief in small actions, you know, even very small actions, being building blocks toward a much greater transformation. And when I don't have the heart to undertake even those small actions, like, nothing's going to happen. Many of you have probably heard me tell the story, probably all of you. I can have you tell it, actually. You know, I tell the story of how we opened the Insight Meditation Society, and within a month we received two letters that were addressed kind of funny. You've all heard that story? I'm going to tell it anyway. Because it's a new unfolding to the story. So the first envelope that was weird, instead of being addressed to the Insight Meditation Society, was addressed to the Instant Meditation Society. And I really thought, that is so funny. Because that's sort of a cultural imperative, right? It has to happen instantly or it's not worth it. And the second letter, instead of being addressed to the Insight Meditation Society, was addressed to the Hindsight Meditation Society. You haven't heard it. I'm so thrilled. And I love that envelope. I love the Hindsight Meditation Society. Because I feel like there have been so many times, first in my meditation life, where I felt like nothing was happening, and it's only been in hindsight that I've been able to look back at that period and say, oh, something was actually happening, but I couldn't tell at the time. And there have been so many times in my life of trying to make a difference in this world where it felt like nothing was happening. And when I'm lucky, I get to look back later in hindsight. You know, like maybe I gave someone a book or something like that and they seem really indifferent. And then sometimes years later, they come back and they say, you know, you gave me that book and it didn't really mean anything to me at the time, but now this whole other thing's happened in my life. And I picked up the book and it was really important. And there's so many times when that has happened to me in one way or another that I am a great, great proponent of the hindsight meditation society. I really believe you just have to do the good in front of you. Even if it seems tiny. Even if you can't imagine where it's going to go. Because it's going to go somewhere. So I tell that story all the time. And the next iteration of it is, or a later iteration of it, it's so odd. Like we've been there for 40 years. And as far as I know, maybe it's because people don't use envelopes anymore. We've only received one other weirdly addressed envelope, which was, instead of being addressed to the Insight Meditation Society, it was addressed to the Insight Meditation Society, like Insight Revolution or something like that. Anyway, so we had this huge party, you know, and I think it was just last Saturday, actually. And so there was a lot of planning and prep work and who's going to speak, and you only had 3 minutes and all this stuff. And so we had one person on staff, you know, one very talented person who organized everything. And so long ago, I got an email from her saying, tell that story. And I said, I wrote back and I said, everyone's heard that story. Like, why would I tell that story? It's like so done, you know? Like, I said, they could tell the story, you know? Like, I said, no, tell that story. Like 2 weeks later, I get an email from her, and she said, you're going to tell that story, right? And I was like, this is so weird. I don't want to tell that story. At one point, I went, like every 2 weeks, I get an email from her, you're going to tell that story, okay? I went to Joseph Goldstein at one point. I said, is she telling you what to say? Or is it just me? And he said, no, she's not telling me what to say. I thought, this is so strange. And then that morning, when we first were opening the center 40 years ago, we had nothing, right? And meditation was like so odd. We couldn't get a bank mortgage. There was no bank that would give us a mortgage. So there were actually three people who very bravely personally took out loans to give us the money to open. Here we were saying, can always close in a year. And two of them, one sadly has since died, but two of them were at the party. So I saw them, you know, right away. So then I saw this woman, and I said, I don't want to tell that story. I want to talk about them. She said, tell two stories then. And then Jack spoke before me also, and he talked about them. So that took that away. So I told the story. And I said, you know, and as is true, like every kind of big anniversary when we have some event, I say, why don't we like make t-shirts that say the Hindsight Meditation Society, or why don't we get cups or something that say the Hindsight Meditation Society? And no one ever goes for it but me. So they then announced that they had had 100 cups made saying the Hindsight Meditation Society. And I got 3. And, you know, because everyone was like staff and board and ex-board and ex-staff and all these people, so they just gave them out. So that's why I had to tell the story, which it took me a little while and I thought, oh, that's why I had to tell that story. You know, but I still, now that I have the cup, I'm really excited. I'm going to England to sit this retreat as soon as I turn in my book. And I got the information sheet from the facility. It said, bring a towel. I was like, all right. And it said, bring a cup. I said, okay. Maybe I'll bring my Hindsight Meditation Society cup. And then it said, bring tea, if you're fond of a certain kind of tea. And I thought, tea to England? This is not looking that good. Like, this is not really a bright prospect that I have to bring my own tea. But anyway, I really fervently believe we do have to do the good that's in front of us. with all the wisdom of the Hindsight Meditation Society, because we don't know. And we do get very disheartened, of course, and it feels like it's going nowhere and it means nothing, and how can it possibly make a difference? And, you know, maybe that's one of the reasons we need to encourage one another, you know, or have a practice so we can settle back into, it's okay not to know where it's going to go, and have the energy to do it. And so that's actually a facet of equanimity, is admitting how much we don't know. But not in a way that has us shrink away from the challenge at hand. You mean joy or sympathetic joy?
Sympathetic joy.
Okay, so why aren't there more guided meditations explicitly about sympathetic joy? Well, there could be. I'm trying to think. I don't know what I've got, like, you know, in the collection of my guided meditations. I mean, there's no reason for there not to be.
I just can't find them.
Yeah. I would actually go to, first of all, Dharma Seed. I don't know if you've been there. And see what they've got. And you can also... have you looked at my website? Have you checked it out? Check it out. I don't know what's up there myself.